Hello and welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. My name's Steve Hall, I'm the CEO, and each week we're bringing you interviews with some of our members, friends and supporters across the wide family of underwater technology organisations across the globe. This week's guest is Bruce Butler, who was involved in the very first missions of an autonomous underwater vehicle under Arctic ice back in the 1990s. So listen and enjoy the story of Theseus. It's absolutely brilliant. If Bruce, if you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure, I'm glad to, Steve. I grew up in southern British Columbia, Canada, and went to the University of British Columbia in 1978, enrolled in first-year science with plans to go into electrical engineering. I found I was more drawn to physics and computer science, so I decided instead to continue in those fields and ended up with a double major. After university, I started working as a software engineer at a local company called Microtel Pacific Research, which was BCTel's research arm.
Okay.
It was challenging work, but it wasn't interesting. So when I saw that a local subsea robotics company called International Submarine Engineering wanted some software engineers, I knew I'd found what I was looking for. I spent 14 years at ISC working on a number of their vehicles, both remotely controlled and autonomous, during which time I applied for and became certified as a professional engineer.
You know, did they send you away to do some additional training for that, Bruce, or were you trained in-house or what?
It was more of a paperwork exercise. I already had the degree and I had the experience, so it was really just filling out a lot of forms. I had to write a few exams, but that was pretty much it.
Okay.
After ISC, I spent several years working in marine navigation at local BC companies such as Canac, Microtel, Offshore Systems, and McDonald Detweiler. I was involved in technologies such as vessel surveillance, differential GPS, marine radio beacon networks, and electronic charting. I then worked in mining automation on the world's first autonomous open pit haul trucks.
Wow, massive things, aren't they?
Yeah. 400 tons of dirt in one haul. So,
yes.
After that, I worked for 10 years at Omnex Control Systems doing system validation for industrial remote control equipment.
Okay. So tell me a bit more about your work back in that ISE period then.
Sure. I started at ISC back in 1985. I was working on the control system software for Dolphin, which is a diesel-powered snorkeling semi-submersible used for hydrographic surveying and mine hunting.
Okay.
That was back in the early days of the computer revolution. We actually wrote code on IBM PCs that had 640 kilobytes of memory and dual floppy disks. We didn't even have hard drives.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then we had to burn the compiled and linked code onto EEPROM chips that were inserted into the vehicle's onboard computer. So it was definitely the old days.
Okay. And was this literally a chip per mission?
Not per mission, no. At that time, the vehicles didn't have missions. They just had, they were remote-controlled vehicles. So we were able to steer them, make them dive, climb, okay, and so on. But no higher-level autonomy at all.
Right. Okay.
I soon transitioned into systems engineering at ISC, and I developed a really keen interest in marine navigation. I got to integrate first a Loran C receiver, then a GPS receiver into the Dolphin so it could actually operate semi-autonomously, just running survey lines back and forth all day. That was back in the days when there were only a few GPS satellites available and only at a few times during the day. Working at ISC was an incredible experience. I was working alongside subsea pioneers like Jim McFarlane, Al Trice, and Mike McDonald. If you're at all up on the history of manned submersibles, you might know that Al and Mike played a key role in the rescue of the Pisces 3 manned sub off Ireland in 1973.
Yes, famous rescue, yes.
Yeah, there's a good book written about that too.
Mm-hmm.
I also got to meet Jacques Cousteau when he visited Vancouver in 1986.
Okay.
And an episode of the old television series MacGyver was filmed at ISC, and I got to meet Richard Dean Anderson.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. I also had the opportunity to work on ARCS, which was Canada's first AUV. designed and built by ISE for the Canadian Hydrographic Service. ARCS, which stands for Autonomous Remotely Controlled Submersible, was to be used to perform under-ice hydrographic surveys in Canada's Arctic waters. I look forward to going to work every day. I got to play with submarines every day, and I felt like I had the best job in the world.
No, inspiring, you know, working with a team like that, you know, it just makes
it was,
doesn't it?
It was, yeah.
So tell me a bit more about, you know, why Theseus was built.
So back in 1987, Canada released a white paper on defense, which, among other things, identified gaps between its capabilities and commitments to NATO. The Cold War was waning at that time, but it was still going, and Canada wanted to assert or reassert its sovereignty over its Arctic waters. They were concerned that Soviet subs were using Canada's waters to transit between the Arctic and Atlantic oceans. The Canadian Department of National Defense started up Project Spinnaker, a joint Canada-US project to install a prototype acoustic listening post on the seafloor on the edge of the continental shelf north of Ellesmere Island. So we're talking like 82 degrees north latitude there.
Okay. And why Spinnaker?
Well, Spinnaker is... the name Spinnaker came from the defense research scientists at Esquimalt in BC because nearby to their base was a pub called the Spinnaker Brew Pub.
Oh, okay. Like all true ocean engineering kind of programs.
Exactly. And as they like to describe it, many of the project's key but not classified decisions were made at the Spinnaker Brew Pub.
Oh, very good. Very civilized.
Yeah. The plan was that the Americans on the team would provide and deploy the acoustic array that would go on the seafloor, while the Canadians would take care of laying the cable from shore out to the array and processing the data. The Canadian defense scientists assigned to Project Spinnaker needed to find a way to lay up to 200 kilometers of cable on the seafloor in Arctic waters that had a permanent ice cover that varied from 2 to 10 meters in thickness.
And even in the summer months, or
yes, yeah,
right.
Yeah. Canada didn't have an icebreaker with that capability, and other options such as, you know, drilling a really long line of holes in the ice and stringing cable through weren't really feasible. So it was ISE's work with the ARCS autonomous underwater vehicle that caught the government's attention. So after some preliminary discussions, we jointly agreed that a purpose-built AUV could do the job. We started a series of feasibility trials using the ARCS as a testbed for developing the needed technologies and operational procedures. In the winter of 1990, we did a series of dives where we laid several tens of kilometers of a small diameter fiber optic cable in local waters. That demonstrated to the government bureaucrats and bean counters that our approach was feasible. So the project was given the green light, and I was assigned the role of systems engineer and was also responsible for the new vehicle's navigation system. The vehicle was named Theseus after the hero from Greek mythology. Theseus is the one who ventured into the labyrinth of Knossos on the island of Crete to slay the Minotaur. He laid down a golden thread on his way into the maze so he could find his way out.
Yes.
Our modern-day Theseus was tasked with a very similar role. Navigate through an Arctic labyrinth of ice and unknown terrain while laying its cable, then turn around and come back out.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, how you designed Theseus, you know, what kind of features it had.
Sure. We used a mission-driven top-down systems approach. Basically, we were building a vehicle for a particular mission. We worked with the scientists from the Department of National Defense to create a pair of formal requirements or specification documents. The first document described specifically what the mission entailed: the route, the distances, the depths, details on the ice cover, and whatever environmental factors were known at the time. As we wrote this mission spec, we quickly realized that we knew very little about the topography of the route where the cable was to be laid. There were a few century-old soundings made by British expeditions, and some more modern but classified soundings taken by U.S. nuclear subs. We were literally going to send Theseus to where no man had gone before.
You know, even though the U.S., I guess, were the client to a large extent, they still weren't able to share the seabed maps with you at the time, I suppose.
They were at one point. I was actually, because I was in charge of navigation, I was given an extra bump in my security clearance and was actually allowed to see the classified charts, because I was the one laying out the mission route. So I had to go work in a special secure room and use a Tempest computer that was totally shielded. And I could look at these charts and plot my route, and no one else in the team was allowed to see the data I was looking at.
Sure. Yes.
So our second specification document was, at a high level, what the solution was to meet the mission. You know, that is the vehicle system itself. From there, we decomposed the system into a number of subsystems, each with its own functional, mechanical, electrical, and performance requirements. Examples of these subsystems would be things like navigation, energy storage, buoyancy control, pressure hull, maneuvering, and so on. I think we ended up with about 17 separate subsystems.
Okay.
And then once each subsystem's requirements were set and approved, it was assigned to an engineer who was responsible for the design, construction, and testing. My job as a systems engineer was to make sure those 17 disparate subsystems worked together to produce a vehicle that would complete the mission.
Okay. So what was it like working with those Department for National Defense scientists?
It was challenging and humbling. They were a very interesting bunch, that's for sure. We were working with guys from the Arctic Acoustics Group at what's called the Defense Research Establishment Pacific, or DREP, which was based at the Esquimalt Naval Base near Victoria, BC. I've never come across a group of more brilliant people. There was literally nothing those guys couldn't figure out.
Yes, yes.
But that said, they were scientists and could easily be sidetracked when something interesting came along.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, our ISE project manager, Alan Pope, did a great job of keeping them on track.
All right. Did you have to develop any new technologies?
Oh, absolutely. We had to build a very large vehicle that could be broken down in sections small enough to be slung under a helicopter or fit through the cargo doors of a Twin Otter aircraft. We needed a navigation system that could get the vehicle 200 kilometers under ice to a precise location, then turn around and come back to the same ice hole it was launched from. We needed an energy source large enough to handle a 48-hour-long mission. We needed to compensate for the change in buoyancy as we dispensed cable. We need a very reliable computer system, both in hardware and software. So there was literally more things we didn't know than we knew.
Wow. So tell me a little bit more about Theseus' navigation system.
Sure. Yeah, that was my baby. So I like talking about that.
Okay.
We ended up deciding on a hybrid inertial/acoustic navigation system. The vehicle would dead reckon using an inertial navigation unit, which basically gave it heading, and a Doppler sonar for ground speed.
Mm-hmm. And was then that a ring laser or a traditional gyro?
No, it was a ring laser. Yeah, solid state. Yeah.
Okay.
And then we'd get the occasional position update from what we call an inverted ultra-short baseline system, which would range off transponders deployed along the mission route.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, we realized that since the mission was basically an out-and-back run north of almost 200 kilometers, heading accuracy was actually paramount. We needed better than a half a degree of accuracy if the ultra-short baseline system worked. And if it didn't, we'd need an order of magnitude better, 0.05 degrees of accuracy, if we were just working off inertial.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty challenging. We tested the nav system in Theseus at a place called the Canadian Forces Maritime and Experimental Test Range, which was off Vancouver Island in British Columbia.
Yeah.
It's a 20-kilometer long range that's outfitted with acoustic tracking, and it's used for testing torpedoes and other military equipment. So in the spring of 1995, we ran Theseus back and forth enough times to simulate the mission duration. And at the end of each 20-kilometer run, we'd check the position error and tweak a few parameters. We were able to get the position accuracy down to 0.05% of distance traveled, which was a staggeringly good number. And that's when I knew we could complete the mission.
Mm-hmm. So how did the construction and testing go?
Because we'd spent a lot of time on the requirements and design, the construction went surprisingly well. The only real problem we had during construction was the machining of the hull end caps. And that was an error on the manufacturer's part and forced us to derate the vehicle's maximum depth, but it didn't affect the mission in the end.
Okay.
We had typical teething problems during construction. Like, for example, the first time we put the vehicle in the test tank, which is basically a large swimming pool, we forgot to install the O-rings on the end cap, so it leaked like a sieve.
Yes.
And as far as sea trials go, they went for us the same as they do for anyone else testing something that goes into the water, especially the seawater. The submarine held to Jim McFarland's first law of sea trials, which is no sub works the first time it touches seawater.
Right.
And also Al Trice's law, which is every submarine leaks. It's just a question of how much. We did all of our sea trials in local BC waters, mostly in a nearby fjord called Indian Arm. Theseus was a massive vehicle. It was over 10 meters long, a meter in diameter, and displaced over 19,000 pounds. Getting it into and out of the water was challenging.
So did you have to use a specialist deployment and recovery system, or were you just using cranes, or what?
We just used the deck crane off our ship, the motor vessel researcher. It was, I think, a 10-ton crane, and we just pick up the vehicle with a two-point lift, carefully swing it around, and lower it into the water. But it was very, very tight on board.
Sure. Okay. And so what kind of batteries were you using?
Well, we had selected for the mission itself some very expensive silver zinc cells because they were the ones with the highest energy density. So during sea trials, we used some old nickel cadmium battery banks, basically the same kinds that we used in the old ARX vehicle. It ended up taking us a better part of a year to wring out the vehicle and get it reliable enough. We originally planned on doing the cable laying mission in 1995, but we didn't get all the software ready in time. You see, there's a narrow time window available for working in the Arctic. After the sun first comes up in the spring, when the temperatures creep above minus 40, but before the pack ice starts to melt, which happens about 8 weeks later. So that delay in our software was bad for the project, but it was good for us as it gave us another year to get Theseus ready. We did end up taking Theseus up to the Arctic in 1995 for some short test dives just to work out the logistics and gain some valuable under ice experience.
All right. So tell me about the actual cable laying mission.
Sure. In March of 1996, we took Theseus apart, crated it, and loaded it into several Canadian Forces C-130 Hercules aircraft for a 4,000-kilometer flight up to Canadian Forces Station Alert, which is on the northern tip of Ellesmere Island. From there, the crates were slung under a helicopter to our ice camp, about 10 kilometers from Alert, where a large tent covered an ice hole, 40 feet long, 6 feet wide, and had been cut through 6 feet of shore-fast ice. There we assembled Theseus, checked it out, and spliced together 11 packs of fiber optic cable, each holding 20 kilometers, then loaded them into the vehicle's free-flooding payload bay.
Okay, and were those fiber optic cable packs just a standard commercial off-the-shelf component?
Oh, absolutely not. The cable was, but getting them wound into the proper size packs with the proper glue and the proper glue... determine the peel-off tension, so that was all very custom.
Right, okay, so it was a custom system specifically to go into the Theseus vehicle.
That's correct, yeah. Right. And each cable pack had a buoyancy compensation tank around it, because as you dispense cable, the vehicle actually gains buoyancy, so we had to counteract that, so we'd flood the tank around each cable pack as we dispense the cable.
Okay. All right. So tell me more about the setup you had.
Sure. It was very complicated and very, covered a large area. The ice camp we launched Theseus from was in a bay with shore-fast ice about 10 kilometers from Alert. We'd already laid an overland cable from Alert's main complex out to the bay, then underground and coming up through the seafloor directly under where the launch ice hole was. The cable coming out of Theseus's dispensing tube was connected to this cross-shore cable, and we ran the mission from Alert, monitoring the vehicle over the cable.
Okay.
So having a practice run in 1985 made things go a lot smoother for us. In the late afternoon of April 16th, we lowered Theseus through the ice hole to a launch depth of 20 meters. Right. The Americans had set up an ice camp out on the edge of the continental shelf, which is just about 200, just under 200 kilometers to the north, and had the acoustic array ready for deployment just a little after midnight that day. We just released Theseus, and I put it into autonomous mode, and we sat back and watched. Having a communications link, the fiber, on the outbound half of the mission was both good and bad, because with an AUV, sometimes knowing what it's doing can be more stressful than not knowing. The mission was mostly boring as the vehicle was doing all the work. We had a few interesting events along the way that kept us on our toes. As Theseus was transiting out of Joliffe Bay at a leisurely 4 knots and flying 30 meters above the seafloor, it had to climb out of a 200-meter deep canyon into shallow water with an unknown ice cover. It was a tense few moments as we watched it climb, pitching up and up, slowly creeping towards a pitch failsafe limit. It cleared the top of the canyon and all was well. But afterwards, when I looked at the flight recorder, I realized we cleared the top of that canyon by only 20 meters. Now, that might seem like a lot, but remember that Theseus itself was over 10 meters long.
Yeah. That brings back memories of some of the issues we had with Autosub a few years later, but please carry on.
Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah. A few other problems we had along the way. Our inverted ultra-short baseline positioning system didn't work very well, likely due to acoustic conditions we weren't prepared for. So when the vehicle tried to get position fixes, it wasn't able to. And every once in a while, the Doppler sonar would just lose bottom lock, which would throw off our nav solution until whoever was at the pilot console corrected it. And we also discovered that the water currents were much higher than expected, which made for some very interesting maneuvers at times. So about 24 hours after launch, Theseus approached the edge of the continental shelf, 175 kilometers to the north, then began climbing up to deliver the cable to the Americans. After they'd lowered the array to the seafloor, leaving a single fiber optic cable coming back to the surface, they deployed a cable recovery loop, which was basically a weighted equilateral triangle made of rope, 200 meters on each side with the vertex pointing down, and Theseus was going to fly through that. We were counting on our onboard ultra-short baseline system to line Theseus up to pass through the middle of the loop, since we assumed that the inertial Doppler solution would have built up too much error.
So was the loop, active in any way? Is it sending out a ping or?
Well, we had placed a pair of acoustic transponders in front of and behind the loop, forming a line. So the idea was if the vehicle homed in on the first beacon and then homed in on the second one, it would pretty much have to go right through the middle of the loop. The acoustics turned out to be crappy that day, and we only got a couple of pings through before the vehicle's ultra-short baseline system stopped working altogether. So that we were watching that on the fiber, and of course, getting a little panicky at that point. Our guys at the ice camp had to scramble to power up their surface-based tracking system, and we were able to get enough hits off the vehicle to confirm that it was flying right through the loop.
That's impressive.
Yeah, they after a long wait, long anxious wait, they recovered the loop and announced to us that the cable was there in the loop. So they cut the cable, spliced it to the cable leading to the array, then stuffed all that cable back down the ice hole.
Wow. And I presume it when, it went on to many years of happy service, I guess.
Well, you'll have to read the story to find out about how that ended. The return transit for the vehicle was mostly uneventful because it was an AUV and we had no communications. So we basically just went and did something else. When Theseus didn't pass by one of the en route ice camps where there was an acoustic beacon, we realized that it stopped somewhere. So we had to go find it. It turns out it had stopped just short of that camp because it couldn't find the beacon, probably again due to lousy acoustics. So we contacted it with acoustic communications gear, got it going again, and about 2 hours later, it was back floating in its launch ice hole. And that was the probably the proudest day of my engineering career, to get that vehicle back. And to add icing to the cake, the guys back at Alert were already receiving data from the acoustic array. So the mission was a success.
Was that the only cable it laid?
Well, that was the original plan, but the guys in charge of the project were so happy that they said, let's do another mission. We have enough spare parts to build another array, and we have enough cable. So let's do another shorter cable laying mission to another array. That second mission didn't go as well. The cable that Theseus was laying broke halfway outbound to the array, probably because of a defect in one of the cable packs. Theseus, however, flew right through the recovery loop completely autonomously, just didn't have a cable with it.
Oh no.
Then its return back to the launch ice hole was fraught with problems, both mechanical and acoustic. It took a very heroic effort on the part of many of our team to repeatedly locate the vehicle under the ice, diagnose the problem, and get it limping a little closer to home. So it took another 7 days before we got the vehicle back. It was battered and missing several external components, but we did get it back.
Okay. And the missing components, was that from hitting bottom or hitting ice? Or
yes, we don't know. Looking at the mission logs afterwards, there were a lot of excursions up. There was a lot of excursions down. You know, we had a problem with the ballast control tanks. So at times the vehicle would sink to the bottom and just basically crash into it nose first. And
oh boy,
yeah, it was. We were really lucky to get the vehicle back.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So what became of the vehicle? What is Theseus doing now?
Well, as I said earlier, Theseus was actually built to perform one mission once, and we managed to do it twice, sort of. As it turns out, if the vehicle had delivered the first cable and never returned, the project would still have been considered successful. And we didn't know that at the time, but that's what one of the project leader told us. He said, if it doesn't come back, I don't care. Since the spring of 1996, Theseus has not touched seawater. It still sits on rails in one of ISC's shops in Port Coquitlam, BC, and is kept looking shiny and new. I was recently chatting with another local subsea legend, CanDive's Phil Newton, about my book. He said he hopes someday there'll be a subsea museum in the Vancouver area and would love to see Theseus sitting proudly in it.
Indeed, yes. You know, historical vehicles shouldn't just be allowed to disappear. So what spin-offs came particularly for ISC out of building Theseus?
There were many spin-offs. First off, ISC immediately became recognized as an expert in under-ice AUV technologies, which is a distinction they hold to this day. Many of the technologies developed for Theseus were used in ISC's robotic manipulator systems and its newer Explorer-class AUVs.
Mm.
They're about one-third to one-half the size of Theseus, but are remarkable nonetheless. In the spring of 2010, an Explorer AUV was deployed from an ice camp west of Ellesmere Island. That was in support of Canada's Arctic survey efforts for its UN Convention on the Law of the Sea submission. During that 10-day mission, it traveled over 1,000 kilometers, smashing several of Theseus's records. And in 2011, that same AUV performed under-ice surveys from an icebreaker above 88 degrees north latitude. In the last few years, ISC sold Explorer-class AUVs to several institutions and governments around the world. In the spring of 2019, last year, an Explorer-class AUV that's operated by the University of Tasmania did missions under the Soarsdal ice shelf in the Antarctic, and it went back again this spring for more work.
Indeed, our listeners will be able to listen to Peter King from the University of Tasmania talking about those very missions in the next episode. So what are you doing these days, Bruce? How does life keep you occupied?
Well, I'm still doing some consulting work in marine navigation, mostly over in the Middle East, on differential GPS marine radio beacons and that kind of thing. And I'm focusing on my writing. I've published two nonfiction books so far, a sort of op-ed analyzing the conflict between drivers and cyclists, because I'm quite a serious cyclist like yourself. And of course, a book about the Theseus and Project Spinnaker. I've also got two new writing projects on the go at the moment, a science fiction novel and a techno-legal thriller.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. You know, law of the sea as it concerns to marine autonomous systems is one of the areas we've been working on as well. So nice opportunities there to get involved with both autonomous underwater vehicles and legal and policy work, particularly when you start putting warheads on the end of them.
Exactly.
So I understand you're still keeping in touch with the people you worked with on the Theseus program.
Yes, it's kind of cool. Everyone I worked with when we were building Theseus and performing the Arctic cable-laying missions in 1996, we all agreed that it was the most challenging and exciting project of our careers. It was truly that once-in-a-lifetime project that every engineer dreams of being part of. That was 24 years ago, hard to believe, and we still all get together at least once a year, usually at a local pub, just to catch up. Most of us have gone into other fields, but a couple of the guys are still at ISE. We're all getting a bit grayer and longer in the tooth, but the bond we developed during Project Spinnaker is one that will last us for our lifetimes.
Indeed, it would. It must have been really exciting work. So how can our listeners find out more about Project Spinnaker, about Theseus, and about your book?
Well, I have an author website I'd love everybody to come check out. It's pretty simple, www.brucebutler.ca. That covers all my writing that I've been doing, past and present. Mm-hmm. And I also have a direct link to the page that discusses this book. It's called, the link is simple, theseusbook.com. And my book is named Into the Labyrinth, The Making of a Modern Day Theseus. And if you go to that website, you'll find there's a photo and video gallery from the project with lots of really cool photos and links to where the book can be purchased. It's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook formats.
Okay. And our listeners will be able to find these links in the show notes when you go to the site that you've downloaded the podcast from. So thank you very, very much, Bruce. It's been brilliant talking to you. When I first started getting involved with autonomous underwater vehicles in the late 90s, Theseus was the program that was held up as the gold standard, you know, the example of guys who'd really pushed the corner of the envelope to see what was possible to do. And it's left a lasting legacy. And I'll be fascinated to read the book myself and find out a little bit more about what became of that cable as well. You know, these things can have quite a long life down on the seabed if everything works perfectly. But of course, the ocean is a hazardous environment. Things don't always go exactly according to plan.
That's right. Yeah.
Indeed. So thanks very much, Bruce. Okay.
Great talking to you too, Steve.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, I really enjoyed talking to Bruce about Theseus. It's such an inspiring project, really pushing the limit of what was possible at the time with an autonomous underwater vehicle. A century from now, when the history of underwater robotics comes to be written, Theseus will be right up there along with the first vehicles to explore underneath the ice of Jupiter's moons, or who knows what kinds of amazing innovations we're going to see in this underwater technology. Now, our next episode, podcast 16, will feature Peter King from the University of Tasmania speaking about the use of the ISC Explorer vehicle for work under Antarctic ice. So it'll be interesting to see a couple of decades on how the technology advanced. So thanks everybody for listening to the podcast. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review. You can find out more about SUT at sut.org. Contact me, Steve Hall, at steve.hall@sut.org. Thank you to Emily Boddy for composing and playing the theme music and creating the podcast artwork. More from us in the next episode very soon. Bye for now.